Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Golfers Show. Oh, I've spilt my beer. Oh, that's gone everywhere. I've got a lager. It's time to talk some golf. Bear with me. And today we're chatting to Aaron Pike. He's an Aussie pro. Now, you may not know him, and that is absolutely fine, but his story is very interesting, and that's what this podcast is all about. The Golfers Show is all about celebrating golf from all angles. This guy is cool, and we'll cross to Aussie in just a moment. Let's get into it. And we're in. Michael Morris, a few words to sum up your feelings as to how you are at the moment. Talk to me.
Well, I was just going to say, how much sleep have you had? Because that was quite an introduction, buddy.
Yeah, I've been sleeping good. I've been feeling good. It's full disclosure, the Golfers Podcast, we decided to launch this during quarantine because it was the only thing we could do to keep our company, Golf Media, going because everything's shut down, locked down. So we're like, well, let's do this. Anyway, throughout this, all we wanted to do was talk to interesting people in the golfing industry. Now, what's happened is our conversation with Sir John Key, the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, a few episodes ago, has ended up in the New Zealand Herald and various other publications. And we're bloody happy about it. Who would have thought when we started this that was going to happen?
That we were going to make the news.
Absolutely. So we are news.
We are news.
That's what I say. So if you're listening to this, thank you for joining us on this crazy ride. We can't wait to see where it goes. Anyway, my mate messaged me and he said, oh, I saw this in the paper, and I got correspondence, I'm sure you did too, Michael, from everywhere, like people all over the place. Oh, I saw this in the paper, this is great. And then my mate goes, that's a good little nudge in the right direction. And that sums it up. You know, it's not like, yeah, we're rich now, I'm going to go buy a Lamborghini. It's just like, that's good, you know? That's just a good bloody thing because you throw so much of your heart and soul into the things that you do, and sometimes you just don't get nothing but kicked in the bum. And then to have a little win like that, it's like, I'm celebrating. That's why I'm drinking a damn lager.
Fantastic. Yeah, no, we just hoped, yeah, to have a good time and to talk to some cool people and see where this would find an audience. And so that's given us a real boost. So, yeah, really appreciate you coming along for the ride with us.
Boom. Mm. Now, developments in the golfing world in the past few days. Handicaps have changed, Michael. Are you across this?
I've seen the post. Tell us about it, Andy.
Okay, so it's quite a complicated thing. A handicap system, trying to explain a handicap system to a non-golfer is honestly like trying to explain LBW and cricket to your partner. It's just not going to happen. You're like, yeah, but it didn't pitch in line. It was going to hit leg, but it was a little high. And you're like, oh, God, this is not going to work. So I'll give you the top lines that I've noticed. And then if you want to dive a little deeper, but in short, your handicap will have changed. I checked mine overnight. It moved about half shot. And for the first time ever, it's going to sound like this is a gloat. It's not a gloat. I'm just excited. And also because I'm having a bit of lager. I'm now on a plus handicap. I've never been on a plus handicap in my life, Michael.
Ooh.
I'm plus point something, which excites me because it just feels cool. You feel like you're the man. So I'll take that. Who would have thought I'd get my handicap the lowest it's ever been during quarantine? But if your handicap has changed, here is why. A few top lines. Now your handicap can be used anywhere in the world and it is valid. Now, I'm not saying before it wasn't, but I know there was some strange kind of like, you know how you kind of have to transfer your money when you go overseas to the new currency. There was a bit of that going on with people's handicaps. So now the handicap, it's kind of like we've got one currency for playing golf around the world now. So that's cool.
Well, I just want to temper that by saying if you can get around the world in the next year or so, that's going to be really, really good.
Yeah, we're only talking to multi-billionaires.
That's right, that's right. Yes.
Bezos, you can play, mate. You can play wherever you want. So before, and forgive me if I get some of this wrong because I've only really just done a shallow dive into this. To get your handicap, the handicap was calculated off 10 of your last 20 cards, your 10 best of your last 20 cards that you handed in. It's now off your best 8.
Wow. Okay.
So that's just reducing the sample size. So that's a thing. Now the handicaps are going to be revised daily as well. So before you'd hand a bunch of cards in, it might be, I think it was weekly or something like that, and then the handicap would be revised over a longer period of time. Now your handicap can change every day. So that's a thing. Final 2 points. This is a great move. It's quite complicated, but the top line is your handicap can be capped based on data from the last year. Now, that's not to make sense immediately, but in short, if you're trying to farm your handicap up, which a lot of people do, particularly heading into you know, the season of playing their club stuff where they try to win everything. You can no longer really do that and get away with it. They've got this complicated sort of explanation online, but in short, if you're farming your handicap, you're going to get caught. Fantastic. Your handicap can be capped. They've got a soft cap and a hard cap. Read into it if you want to know more. The farmers, you're done. And finally, slope rating can be moved based on conditions. Now, that may not make sense either, but basically, if you're new to golf, every course in the world has a slope rating, which is a rating of difficulty. Now, that's even complicated in itself. They come up with that. But basically, every course gets a number. You're this number. You're that number. Now, the slope rating can be moved based on the conditions of the course, which is great. Because before, it was just a singular slope rating, and then that was it. That was your rating of difficulty. But obviously, some days the weather can be really crap. Some days they might put the tees way back. Some days they might put the pins in really hard positions. All that sort of stuff can now be factored into the new slope rating. So there you go. That is what I see as the latest developments. I could be wrong on some of that. If I am wrong, let me know. Because let's be honest, I did a very surface level research into this. And now let's get to Aaron Pike. And here he is now, Aaron Pike in Brisbane. How are you, sir?
Yeah, really good. How are you guys?
Yeah, I think we're doing pretty well.
We're at home, that's for sure. What about you, mate? Whereabouts are you coming from?
I'm actually at my my girlfriend's house at the moment. But yeah, we're a bit like you guys. We're kind of pretty confined at the moment, obviously, with the current situation.
And what do you make of that as a pro golfer?
Well, it sucks because I don't get to play any tournaments, but I completely understand it. So, but I think I'm in the same boat as nearly everyone in the workforce, unfortunately. But I completely understand the necessary evils that have to go on because of it.
Mm. Have you joined the craze of Zoom or iPhone golfing tips during this lockdown period, mate?
No, I haven't. I haven't jumped on the video calling and yeah. All that kind of stuff. It's not really my go, to be honest.
So how many years have you been on the grind, Aaron?
I turned pro at the end of 2007. So about September 2007. So what's that now? It's nearing on 13 years.
And before you turned pro, you hit the limelight real quick in 2006. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, I did quite well in a European tour event here in Australia, the MasterCard Masters. And, I led that with two holes to go. Justin Rose managed to just pit me in the end. Don't know if you've heard of him, but he's kind of a big deal. Nah. So I did quite well there. I also did quite well in another professional event in New South Wales, PGA it was at the time. I think Scotty Draper ended up actually winning that. And then I won a whole bunch of sort of amateur, state amateurs and all that kind of stuff here locally. Yeah, so that's probably sort of the 2006, 2007 sort of period.
Yeah. So you've dominated the amateur scene and there's talk of you everywhere. Everyone in Aussie's like, yeah, Aaron Pike, that guy knows what he's doing. And then you turn pro. Can you talk us through that transition?
Yeah, I probably got chewed up and spat out by the pro system immediately, through no fault unto my own or anyone else. It's just some people, some things just sort of don't click, don't do well. It was quite sort of daunting sort of moving into that sort of scene. I didn't really have a strategic plan sort of where I wanted to go, how I wanted to go about it. I kind of tried to play in the States. I tried to play up in Asia. I tried to play in Australia. I tried to do a whole bunch of things. And in all honesty, reflecting, looking back, there was no plan. There was no process sort of put in place to sort of go forward. And that would be the biggest thing I sort of felt. I tend to also think that the amateur system, albeit it's changed somewhat now, I think it was set up with flaws in it that didn't really help us when we sort of moved and transitioned into professional golf. And that's, I think Australia and New Zealand probably same sort of concepts there, whereas I think the New Zealanders probably look after their own a little bit better and stuff like that. But
well, that's an interesting insight there, Aaron, because I've always assumed that the transition in golf in Australia would have been more resourced and it would have been smoother simply because, you know, bigger population, more opportunities, more money floating around, but not the case.
Yeah, I understand your logic, but my issue with it is exactly what you're talking about is especially when I was going through, everyone was babied. Everyone was, everything was meticulously planned out and organized and done for them. And from my perspective, as soon as I turned pro, then I had to do all that stuff on my own. There was no ownership on, you know, sourcing a medical team, sourcing coaches, all of these kind of things. It was a lot of the, it was just, we were spoon fed. Not to say that that's the right or the wrong thing, but there's been a lot of good people, good players fall by the wayside, and there's been some ones that weren't very good in amateur golf and all of a sudden have come through and been a shining light. So it's, I guess it's, you know, it's horses for courses, but I think the US system is by far the most prominent. They would just play these kids into the ground until they played that many holes that they knew exactly how to play the game of golf. They knew what they had to do, and that was where they went from there. Whereas in Australia, we're a bit too much of the perfectionist style, in my opinion. You know, we're always hell-bent on having the perfect golf swing or the perfect chipping action and putting stroke and all of this kind of stuff. At the end of the day, there's a little white ball. I've just got to get that in the hole.
You never see a New Zealand pro with a bad swing, do you? Or not, I say bad's the wrong word, an unattractive swing. They all, and when I say New Zealand, I'll factor Aussie in that too. You don't see many strange, you know, antipodean movements out there in the pro scene.
Yeah, it's probably a fair analogy. The Kiwis and South Africans probably got the most gorgeous golf swings going around, that they always have. I talk back to even the guys, you know, older than myself, the Mark Browns, Tatarangi, all of these kind of boys. They swing the club flawlessly. Like, even when you see Michael Campbell, albeit he's a lot older now, and I never played with him or against him when he was in his prime, but you watch him swing it now and you know it's no different to what it was back then. It's unbelievable. But even the other guys, the guys that have fallen, like your brother, he swings it unbelievable. And then even the guys like Brad Isles, all these kind of guys, the Mark Purses, I can name them one after the other. James Gill, who I used to play against, with Brendan Stewart, Nick Gillespie, all of them were just, they all swung it amazingly. And if you look in recent times, the one guy that's probably popped his head out of the scene the strongest is the one that probably got the most flack when he was growing up, with the bow legs and the big, powerful, broad golf swing, and it's Ryan Fox. And he's the one that's actually, you know, he's probably moved into that sort of next phase in professional golf. He's gone through Australia, through Europe, and he's clearly on his way to bigger and better things.
So, yeah, absolutely. So when you you know, you jump to the pro scene in 2007, and then, you know, you go through, you're in the pit, you know, you had a lot of learning to take place, stuff that, you know, you've been sideswiped and uppercut by the whole thing. How long did it take before you started getting on top of things and started making sense again?
Yeah, well, the first sort of early period was, I didn't play great, sort of basically the first year. The end of my second year, I started to put some good results on the board and some better tournaments from memory. And then 2010, I had to get knee surgery. And then at the end of 2010, I actually had to get shoulder reconstruction. Oof. And that was a huge setback. That in all honesty, that the shoulder surgery was something that was really drastic, was really difficult for me to sort of go through. Recovery-wise, my golf swing changed huge amounts post that. That was really difficult to come back from. Had to sort of rebuild the golf swing, relearn how to play the game of golf again. I didn't sort of get back into it till 2011, but in all honesty, it took a couple years after that. I played pretty ordinary for a while, and a couple years after that, I would say then my performances really started to pick up again and sort of get back to what I was used to.
Which would have been, at what age were you at that point?
Born in 85, so it would have been 25, 26 sort of period.
Okay, I mean, that's a young age to go through all that.
Yeah, it was difficult. So it was... There was sort of moments when the shoulder went, it was like, well, do I really want to keep doing this? Do I sort of, is this a road I want to sort of go down? The shoulder injury actually happened in a tournament while I was playing in Korea. I hit a shot out of some grass on an upslope. Grass was thick as, didn't think anything of it because you don't really think much like that. And as I hit it, I felt something pop in my right shoulder. I instantly let go of the golf club. I kind of didn't know what to do. To be honest, I shit myself, and the ball actually went to about 3 foot. And I didn't really know. Everyone was sort of clapping, and then I went up there and I tapped it in. And by the time I tried to tee off on the next hole, I couldn't feel my right arm, and I just had to basically walk off the golf course then and there.
Oh, man, that sucks. That must have been awful.
Yeah, it was. But there's many other golf golf pros that have had injuries and problems, but realistically it sucked. But I didn't really know sort of at the time what was going to come of it or where it was going
to
head.
So fast forward to now, 2020, you're still playing golf. Can you talk to us about your last few years? Because it sounds like it's quite a heavy plot.
Just the last couple of years. Well, 2015, I think I finished 15th or so on the Australian money list. I think I played really well in your National Open, actually. If it wasn't that one, it might have been the year after. Sort of 2015-16, played really, really good. 2016, at the end of the year, I started to feel something in my back and my hip, and I didn't really know what to do. I kept playing, and then I played, I finished 2016, and then I got starting to get ready for 17, and then I had to get knee surgery on my other knee, and I tried to get ready. I played your National Open, and I wasn't ready. I couldn't play, and then I got nerve damage in my back. I didn't play for the rest of 2017, skipped the whole year, continually trying to get back, trying to get ready. And it, in all honesty, it was the most brutal time of my life in terms of golf because I was continually trying to get ready, trying to be prepared, and my back would blow out. I was seeing doctor after doctor after doctor. I got admitted into hospital because of seizures, nerve damage I was having in my back. So it was a really dark time. Fast forward 2018, I started the season out and I thought, stuff it, let's see what happens. I started working with a new guy body-wise. He was helping me a hell of a lot, changing my golf swing to relieve pressure, changing my training patterns, hitting balls, all this kind of stuff. 2018, I start to play really well towards the back half of the year and I win my first tournament on tour, win the Vic PGA. I contend in the Australian Open. I contend in every tournament basically to end the year. And then 2019 rolls around and I think I've got to be serious and train hard and do all the things that you think you're meant to do. And I just blew myself out the first half of the year. I was just absolutely knackered and I was really struggling. I didn't play great at all through the year, I wouldn't say. And I got to the Aussie Open and I finished third at the Aussie Open. And in all honesty, the game felt great, but the mind didn't feel good. And that result really did come. It just sort of popped its head up out of nowhere.
Wow. And then, man, there's so much there. So in 2018, have you kind of mentally just gone, it is what it is, and just really just let it go? You've just given up expectation.
Yeah, 100%. That's exactly what happened in 2018. In 2017, like I previously had golf taken away from me. In 2018, it didn't, like, I could hit the ball in the middle of the pond and I still had a massive grin on my face. I did not give a shit one bit. It was awesome, you know. I just didn't care. It was just, and everyone, the people closest to me said it was just like, it was completely different. I honestly just did not give a shit. It was, and results sort of happened because of it. And I was out playing golf. You know, I honest to God didn't think I was going to play competitively again. I thought I might be able to play at my home golf club, have some fun. But I did not think for one second that I was going to be playing at a level that I was. And so when I got it back, I certainly didn't take it for granted. But then on the flip side of that, when I did sort of start performing, that was when the expectations really kicked in 2019, probably. It was a kind of a revelation for me. It was, I thought golf was taken away from me. I genuinely didn't think I'd play again, in all honesty, competitively. So, yeah, to be out there, I was honestly, you know, pissing down with rain, whatever. I did not give a crap. I was out there having fun. It was awesome. I honestly wish I could have it every single time I went out and played golf, in honesty. I'm endeavouring to try and get back there. I'm doing everything I possibly can, in all honesty, to sort of get the mindset right for Aaron Pike, which I understand is always, you know, it's not the same for everyone. Like what Aaron Pike does or Ricky Fowler does or Ryan Fox does is always going to be different. But for me, I need to be as calm, as free-flowing and as relaxed as possible, which is why when people sort of watch me, they think that either A, I don't care or I'm just actually joking around when I'm out there.
It always fascinates me, Aaron, the journey of a pro golfer where it seems to go from a game to a job, back to a game, back to a job, and sometimes even back to a game before it being the job again. What would you say to your 21-year-old self if you could go back and have a chat to that young Aaron before he embarked on his professional career, what would you say to him just to prepare him for the next 10, 15 years, mate?
Firstly, I'd tell him to invest in Google and Apple. And then after that, I would tell him to realize that no matter where you hit that golf ball, it's really not the worst possible thing that can happen. It doesn't matter. It doesn't mean anything. How you react to that, it is everything. You can't change it. I've been pent up, worried too much about what's going to happen rather than what has happened too much. So I would tell myself to not live in the past, live in the future.
That's powerful. That's really cool stuff. So you push through 2018, expectation starts creeping back in 2019, and then boom, you qualify for the British Open.
Yeah, that was a bit of a whirlwind, honestly. The start of the year, I went to China, got my PGA Tour China card, played up there quite a lot, was flying back and forth from the States to China and Australia, sort of doing it all, doing a lot of practice in the States, playing in China, playing whatever was on in Australia as well. Put too much expectation on myself, and kind of the back half of the year just thought, you know, stuff it. Let's just get back to basics. I sort of made the point to talk to some good golfers that I know that in my life, to give me a little bit of guidance. They helped me quite a bit, and tried to put some things in place to sort of start getting, you know, the car back on the road, so to speak, and do the right things mentally. And then boom, yeah, second last tournament of the year, I qualified for the biggest tournament in the year, which is amazing.
Wow. So am I right in saying, Aaron, and forgive me if I've received this anecdote wrong, but you were pretty close to pulling the pin again. Is that right?
Yeah. It was... I haven't told too many people this, but on the Tuesday of the Australian Open, I turned to one of my closest friends who caddies on the US tour, and another one of my good friends who plays on tour. And we were just there just on Tuesday doing some stuff, and they were where I was staying. And I turned to them and I just said, after 2019, I'm done. I'm not going to play anymore. I'm going to finish these two tournaments out, and I think that'll be the end of it playing wise for me. Lo and behold, 5 days later, I'm in the third last group, and you know, I'm got a 2-footer to qualify for the, in my opinion, the biggest tournament in the world. It's the tournament that I've always aspired to play in, contend in, and win, and that's to go that roller coaster. Even though it was 4 or 5 days, it was incredible. And even to the Sunday night when with those same guys, I spoke to them and they both looked at me and said, well, what are you doing now? So, but yeah, your information is 100% correct. On the Tuesday I was done, and on the Sunday I'm fully back into playing golf again.
Wow, that is so crazy. What it sounds like, Aaron, that it sounds like as soon as you remove expectation and an over-identification with the result, you prevail.
That would be 100% correct. That's what I've surmised. That's what the guy I've been doing work with mentally, he's also believes. If I was to take expectation out of every shot that I do, that he and I sort of believe that it'd be hard pressed to find a bad performance.
Do you meditate, Aaron?
No, I don't. I've never done it. I'm fully into trying anything or sort of any concepts that are new or different or experimental. So I'm at the moment working with a guy who I'd say he's a little bit left field, but yeah, I'm open to doing all of that kind of stuff.
It's an interesting time because that stuff, like when you say meditation around sort of your typical Kiwi, your typical Aussie, because I think we have a lot in common, there is sort of a dismissive attitude, which I've had for the longest time, where it's like, oh, what's next? Are we going to bloody get a candle on and sing Kumbaya and make love to each other? Is that what we're doing here? But yeah, it's cool to hear that that's something you may be interested in, because I think for what my opinion's worth, it's definitely helped me in my life and a lot. And when you talk about expectation, even on my micro scale playing, you know, yours is obviously higher stakes, higher everything, higher ability, all of that. But I found being able to manage expectation with adopting some form of meditation or understanding of that sort of awareness has definitely skyrocketed me and my own little silly challenges in the game. So
I don't disagree with anything that you're saying there. So I think there's a huge place for it, given done right, and with the right person.
Mm, absolutely. So then we get to the next kink in the road. You've qualified for the, was it the 150th?
149th at Royal St. George's.
So that was going to be played this year, and you're obviously weirdly excited and all of that sort of stuff, and then COVID comes along and that wipes it away for you.
Yeah, that's basically it in a nutshell. The hardest thing is qualifying for it 7 months before it's actually on, in all honesty. Waiting for that is just beyond horrible. And then to sort of have it taken away is crazy as well. It was, I remember speaking to Dimi Papadatos. He qualified for it the year previous. I actually played with him on the Sunday, and then he qualified for it. And he said to me, he goes, just be ready, because everyone is going to want to talk to you about this for the next 7 months, and you're actually going to get sick of talking about it. And you just want to play that tournament. So, and he was 100% right, and I only got to March.
It's out for this year, so you don't get an automatic into next year. What's the situation as it stands at the moment?
No, sorry. As of April the 6th, the RNA made an announcement saying that everyone that was already qualified for Royal St. George's this year will be qualified for Royal St. George's next year. So I was, in all honesty, I was planning to not be playing. To be brutally honest, I genuinely thought that they were just going to cancel it and I was going to miss out. And I thought next year would be at St. Andrews and they would just carry on. But, I've been completely blessed, in all honesty, that I'm still eligible to play next year, albeit I've got to wait, but I'm happy to do that. Mm.
So between, obviously, the world's upside down all over the place at the moment. So at this point, what does that wait look like for you based on the current climate?
Yeah, they've announced that they're going to be holding the Open Championship next year, I think 15th to the 18th of July. So it's almost the identical dates that they've got it planned for this year. That'll be when I'll be heading over to play it.
Far out. And it's pretty cruel that they do it at 7 months, and obviously you understand that, but golf is such a game of momentum.
Oh, it is. It'd be amazing to qualify the week before, but no, yeah, I'm happy to take anything, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Aaron, it's been so good to talk to you. You're the first international guest on the Golfers Show.
Oh, wow. We'll have to get a few more on you.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, can you help us tap into some of those Aussies over there as well?
Yeah, not a problem. We can get a few of them on there.
Awesome. Well, Aaron, all the very best. We love doing this show because we're able to, you know, cast a light on areas of the game that we feel have been neglected. It's all well and good talking about Tiger and his highlights. Don't get me wrong. That's the greatest stuff that's ever happened. But there's also amazing stories in amongst this crazy professional game and all other aspects of the game as well. So, and yours is certainly one of those. All the best, sir. Go well. Lift that damn cup next year.
Cheers. Thank you. Bye.
Great stuff. Cheers, bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, that was cool. A couple of moments there where I was just really, you could feel sort of the heaviness of his words. You know, he really cares. One of the things I definitely noticed when we were growing up playing was people didn't like to be perceived. I don't know if this is just a New Zealand thing, but people didn't like to be perceived as though they cared, because therefore if they failed, they had an out clause, which was, I didn't really care anyway. Mm. So to hear someone speak so openly about how much they care is really nice and refreshing, because, you know, by openly stating how much you care about the game and your performance and your effort, you are setting yourself up for landing short. And by landing short, you've failed. And by failing, people see that you fail and you get judged. So that was blimmin' cool. And not something I say often, but I really enjoyed talking to that damn Australian.
Yeah, I mean, wasn't it fascinating, that stuff that he was saying about the transition, about from amateur ranks to professional, and how he felt like he just was, I wouldn't say hung out to dry, but it sounded like it, didn't it? That there was such a brutal transition for him, and I'd never really thought about that. And it's been repeated a couple of times by some of the people we've talked to, haven't they, about that brutal transition, that everything's done for you, and then the next day, you're on your own.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be like, it's kind of like with your kids going, no, I'll give you a house, I'll pay for everything, da 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 da. And then it's like they turn 18, right, you've got to cover your insurance, go to do the shopping, you know, go get a job. Like it's a heavy cliff to fall off. I wonder, is that typical across professional sport? Because, yeah, it seems like there's a real disconnect there.
Well, golf's a very individual sport. I mean, it wouldn't be the same in team sport, would it? You go into a team environment, it's so different because you've got, you know, whatever the sport may be, 10, 12, 15 of your mates around you, or a squad of 20 or whatever, all going through the same thing. But golf, it's so individual, so so solitary. And then it's sort of down to the character and the background of each person to kind of take that on. And it sounds like he could have done with maybe a mentor or somebody a little bit earlier on in his life to guide him towards where he was heading. What do you think?
Mm, definitely. Because if you don't have the business nous and you don't understand, if you don't have like a support network around you, you're so screwed. You know, you've got to really understand the nature of the beast, because if you're not fully in the loop, you'll just get out there and you'll just be left out to dry. So anyway, all the very best, everybody. Hope you're well. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time on The Golfers Show. This has been a lot of fun. And onwards and upwards from here is going to be great.
Bye.
Bye.